The Conservatives have secured their biggest lead over Labour since last summer, amid signs that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is benefiting from a vaccine bounce, the latest opinion poll for The Observer has revealed. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer journalist Michael Savage. The piece is titled Johnson's Poll Lead Over Labour Boosted by COVID Vaccine Rollout. Stay with us for more of Michael Savage's article. The Conservatives have secured their biggest lead over Labour since last summer, amid signs that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is benefiting from a vaccine bounce, the latest opinion poll for The Observer has revealed. A year into the coronavirus pandemic, the poll gives the Tories a 7-point lead over Labour, up from 5 points a fortnight ago. It is the biggest lead since July, with the Conservatives on 43% of the vote and Labour down 1 point on 36%. It also suggests greater public support for the government's handling of the latest phase of the pandemic and a roadmap out of lockdown measures. In the week of the budget, the opinion poll revealed that the Tories maintain a clear lead over Labour in terms of economic trust. Almost two-fifths, or 39% of those who took part, said they most trusted Boris Johnson and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak to handle the economy, whilst 25% back Keir Starmer and the Shadow Chancellor Annalise Dodds. The findings represent a reality check for Labour and Keir Starmer, who managed to eliminate a huge Tory lead after taking over from Jeremy Corbyn last April. He used a major speech this month to give details of his plans for the economy, pledging to build a strong partnership with businesses in the post-COVID recovery. The latest opinion poll suggests that public opinion is beginning to shift. Approval of the government's handling of the COVID pandemic has risen, with 36% now approving, up 3 percentage points, and 45% disapproving, unchanged from a fortnight ago. About 47% think the government's roadmap for the easing lockdown restrictions in England is set at the right pace. However, 31% of those who took part believe it is too quick, and 12% believe it is too slow. Approval of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, which has been low for some time, is recovering. About 39% of those who took part in the opinion poll approve of the job that Boris Johnson is doing, and 41% disapprove, giving him a net score of -2. Keir Starmer's approval rating is also up slightly, with 33% approving of the job he's doing and 28% disapproving, giving him a net score of +5. Boris Johnson holds a lead when it comes to who would make the best Prime Minister, with 33% backing him and 25% backing Keir Starmer, down 2 percentage points on a fortnight ago. Adam Drummond, Associate Director of Opinion Research, said, "After spending much of 2020 on the back foot regarding his handling of the coronavirus, the ongoing success of the vaccine rollout has rejuvenated the government's poll ratings, with a now clear Conservative lead over Labour, as well as improvements in Boris Johnson's job approval figures. Unlike the 2020 summer or Christmas unlocking, both of which voters were sceptical of, this time the government's planned roadmap is seen as about right by most voters." Adam Drummond added, "With the budget this week, the discussion moving on to economics also favours the Conservatives, with Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson have a substantial lead over Keir Starmer and Annalise Dodds. The question is whether the Chancellor's announcements will maintain that advantage, given the public appetite for increased spending and taxes on corporations and high earners. Opinion polled 2,003 people online on 25th and 26th of February.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-Ardha ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about ladies related Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let me ask you a question at the beginning of this episode. if a woman has a surgical operation due to a special kind of disease related to the private parts, for example, all right?
Yes, sure.
Such as the womb. And she's not she's bleeding even after many days.
Yes.
Related to that part or those parts. And does she have to perform ghusl in this case? What is she supposed to do in that case, in that regard?
Blood which is discharged by a woman as a result of a surgical operation is impure by itself, in of itself, it is impure. Blood is always impure, okay?
Yes.
Whether it comes from the private part or from any other parts of the body, it is impure. But this blood which comes out because of a surgical operation, it is impure and it has to be washed off. For example, if a woman is wearing a pad or using a pad, and the pad is stained with blood, the pad has to be washed, and the woman has to wash her private part, and there is nothing she should do. Like, there is no ritual bathing, ghusl does not become obligatory upon her, and she should continue offering her prayers and also fasting. Because it's not the blood of menses, it's not the blood of nifas, it's not the blood of istihaza, which we call irregular blood, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Irregular bleeding. It is the blood oozing out or coming out of injury. That blood is najis and it has to be washed. If it spreads out to the underwear, to the trousers, okay, that trouser has to be taken off, and then the trousers should be washed, the pad should be thrown away, and of course the woman should make sure that there is no blood so that she can offer prayers, and also of course she can fast without washing herself, but as far as praying is concerned, she mm-hmm. should wash herself and make her clothes clean and pure.
And you say that even despite the fact that she suspects that this is the time for her monthly period as always, as usual.
If she suspects, okay, because a person has to, a woman has to look whether it is the blood of wound or the menstrual blood.
Because some women, in fact, happen to mark their calendar, like, according to their calendar, for example, they're going to experience like 5 days of menstruation, all right?
Yeah.
So if that happens, that period of seeing the blood, all right, happens to be concurrent with the time with of their menstruation.
Sure, sure.
So how she should consider this?
Differentiate, like, at least.
Differentiate or recognize that this is the menstrual blood or no, the surgical blood.
Yeah, you're right. Well, as we discussed it in the previous episode, the blood of haiz is warm, okay? It comes with irritation.
Yes.
It is dark in color, mostly, and it's it is red, extremely red. So, and it tilts, it leans towards darkness, mm-hmm. okay? And it comes with irritation. These are the signs which must be taken into consideration. If blood is thick, warm, and red, and it comes with irritation, then that should be taken as the blood of haiz.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
if not,
then she should assume that it's still the blood of the wound, and the blue of the wound. And normally, the wound it does not come. Let's say it does not continuously flow. Okay, it might come off and on that there, and it's very easy to, because if there is pain, if there is kind of, let's say, if she has recently had the surgical operation, then it definitely indicates that she is discharging the blood of it's the blood of the surgery, not the blood of menses.
Yes,
it's the woman herself who can differentiate and distinguish.
office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Should all of these signs for the menstruation be taken altogether, or some of it could justify and characterize as menstruation?
It's not necessary. You see,
as you said, irritation, or the color, for example.
As I said earlier also, that if none of these signs are present, if none of these signs are there, you can still consider yourself as menstruating.
Yeah.
And because you know that it's time you had your menses, for example, are a woman that those women who have a fixed habit of menstruation, they know that, for example, on the 15th or on the 20th of every month they will discharge the monthly the menstrual blood. So none of those signs are present. The blood is not warm, it's not, you see, dark, but she has just started having that blood, so she can consider herself as a woman in the state of menstruation.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Can a menstruating woman enter or visit a graveyard, a cemetery?
Yes, this is also one of the questions directed by Indian women, by Shia Muslims living in the Indian subcontinent, because I know very well, I have been in touch with these questions. Of course, these are questions which are directed to the religious authorities by the Shia, Indian Shia Muslims. Of course, a woman in the state of Hayz can visit graveyards. They can visit their relatives, actually graves. They can attend a funeral procession, and they can visit their relatives. They can attend religious ceremonies, and all of these are allowed. Mm-hmm. So it is a kind of misunderstanding, I can say, on the part of Indian women, who, because of not being very much in touch with religious sources, with genuine Islamic literature,
yes.
So they lack some kind of information, and because of that they are very much falling into some kind of misconception, unfortunately. And some of them are heavily under the influence of the majority Sunni population. They learn their ahkam from Sunnis, not because they do not have access to internet. They do not know how to use the internet, and also they don't have access to the risala, and they do not even think that the religious authorities' risala could be read online,
mm-hmm.
or they could be downloaded. Because these are the people, normal people. Otherwise, the young generation know very well how to download or how
especially
to get access.
Traditional people, in fact, used to this kind of life of traditions and sunnah, you know, and they are very traditional people. They live a traditional life, and they are not really up to date.
Yeah, they are not. Most of them are, you know, and most of them are living in rural areas. They don't have to internet connection, and that's why we see that a lot of people living in India, they want a manual Islamic law. book of manual, a manual book of Islamic laws.
Yes.
They want to read it, and because they don't have internet to access to internet, so they keep asking the religious authorities for the book to be sent to their postal address, so that they can read it.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Trump has been unusually quiet about his future plans, but sources close to the former president say that in his upcoming speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida, he will attempt to brand himself as both the current leader of the GOP as well as the presumptive nominee for 2024 presidential election, says Chris Walker, writer in an article published under the heading, Romney says Trump will be GOP nominee if he runs in 2024. Here's more. Speaking about the future of the Republican Party on Tuesday, February 23rd, Senator Mitt Romney said it's very likely that former President Donald Trump would win the nomination for president if he decided to run again in 2024. I don't know if he will run in 2024 or not, but if he does, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination, Romney said in an interview with the New York Times. Romney also acknowledged that a lot can happen between now and 2024, but stuck to his prediction that Trump would be the nominee if he chose to run. He cited polling data for the reason he held to this belief, noting that Trump was far beyond where any other potential candidate was at in terms of preferences for the next presidential election. A look at the polls, and the polls show that among the names being floated as potential contenders in 2024, if you put President Trump in there among Republicans, he wins in a landslide, Romney said. Polling does indeed show Trump ahead of the rest of the GOP pack of potential candidates. When Republican voters were asked who they preferred among a list of names, including Romney's, for the 2024 nomination, most of those surveyed showed a clear preference for the former president. Romney garnered 4% support in a recent Political Morning Consult poll from earlier this month, while fellow Senator Ted Cruz received about 3%. Former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley garnered 6% and former Vice President Mike Pence received 12% of backing from those taking part in the poll. Trump outdid them all, receiving 54% support from Republican respondents to run for president in 2024. Some have suggested, however, that Trump should not set his eyes solely on the White House. Speaking to a group of Republicans earlier this month, Steve Bannon, who was briefly the chief strategist to Trump during the first year of his presidency, said Trump should also consider a congressional run between now and 2024. If Republicans won the House in 2022, Bannon said, and if Trump was among those who ran and won, he could convince the GOP caucus to let him become Speaker of the House as well, ousting current Speaker Nancy Pelosi from the position. Trump could then run for president 2 years later if he still wanted to do so. Trump is a disruptor, but he has a long-term vision because I absolutely believe in the marrow of my bones that he will be the nominee in 2024, Bannon explained. He will come back to us, so we will have a sweeping victory in 2022, and he will lead us in 2024. Bannon also attempted to feed into the big lie being perpetrated by Trump loyalists of Biden being an illegitimate winner in 2020 due to election fraud, a claim that has absolutely no basis in reality, they said. As a Speaker of the House, Trump could in theory try to rectify what supposedly happened to him, Bannon noted. The first act of President Trump as a Speaker of the House will be to impeach Joe Biden for his illegitimate activities of stealing the presidency, the former advisor said. Trump has been unusually quiet about his future plans, but sources close to the former president say that in his upcoming speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida, he will attempt to brand himself as both the current leader of the GOP as well as the presumptive nominee for 2024 presidential election. Some of those sources have also said Trump is planning to be a kingmaker in 2022 midterm election, supporting candidates that are loyal to him while attempting to oust those in the party who weren't always on his side when he was in office. He will undoubtedly get a lot of support from Republican voters no matter what route he takes. But while polling data does show Trump has a strong chance to woo over Republicans in the next presidential primary process, Americans overall are not happy with the idea, with 54% of voters from all political leanings saying they'd rather he remove himself from politics entirely versus remain in GOP politics, according to a recent CNBC All-America Economic Survey published in February.
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president's Abu Rabah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital, Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeidah, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the 6th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse, as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense agency review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon. He has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found fault with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq War and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump and some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
To the light. An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 6 to 5 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians, who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver along a route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance, yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online, performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at Adubo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has three siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make, I think for me, make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enabled her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple. And the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message here. People in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lapajärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt Ice Shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming, and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers, and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
IRIB English Radio.